Rams on Sunday, costing the Green Bay Packers a chance to win that game. Montgomery says he made a split-second decision because the ball came down close to the goal line and he did not want to take a knee in the wrong place. He also said he was disappointed by criticism that he is taking from an anonymous teammate. In the NBA, the Bucks stay undefeated after beating Toronto 124-109 last night. The Bulls lost to Golden State 149-124. Bucks and Bulls are both off tonight. And in the NHL, the Blackhawks were off last night. They're off again tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, October 30th. It's going to be a cloudy day today, a little breezy, rain developing late this morning, continuing into the afternoon, and then continuing into the nighttime as well. Today's high 58, tonight's low 45. Tomorrow looks great, partly sunny and 55. The new numbers are in, wind from the southeast at 12. We do have clouds, but a little sunshine. 50 degrees in Racine, 49 in Kenosha, 50 to the west for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is up shortly.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a great pleasure to be able to talk about a masterpiece, and there's just no other word for the play, The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams. When I think back to the plays that have most powerfully moved me and affected me, The Glass Menagerie is way at the top of the list. I remember fondly several different productions that I've been privileged to see over the years, and also remember several different on-screen productions of this that just have only underscored the greatness of this piece. And we have the opportunity here in southeastern Wisconsin to experience The Glass Menagerie in a series of performances that are being presented by a relatively new entity on the fine arts landscape here in southeastern Wisconsin, Fleeing Artists Theater. And their production of The Glass Menagerie is going to be opening this coming weekend and running for three consecutive weekends at the Rohde Center for the Arts. Joining us today on the morning show is, first of all, Alex Metalski, who is one of the three co-founders of Fleeing Artists Theater and also their communication outreach director. And he is co-directing this production and also appearing in it as the gentleman caller. His co-director, Kenneth Motley, is with us as well. And Denise Johnson, who is portraying the role of Laura. And we welcome all three of you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, happy to have you here. So, Alex, as one of the co-founders, it's probably good for me to direct this question to you about kind of the genesis of Fleeing Artists Theater. And I hope as you talk about why this theater company was created, you'll also explain the intriguing title of it or name of it.
Sure. Yeah, we think it's intriguing. Sure. So it came about because a few of my friends, Kenny, who is here, and Kevin Duffy, who is in the show playing the role of Tom, wanted to put on shows that certain audiences might enjoy, but the masses might not.
So you're thinking about works that are maybe sometimes either literally avant-garde, that's kind of cutting edge, yeah, or works that are maybe very deep dramas that are not necessarily what draw in people by the thousands
exactly,
to see. I mean, generally speaking, community theaters tend to think in terms that are a little bit lighter fare, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but you are trying to, in a sense, widen the palette maybe of
exactly
what's being seen.
Exactly. And the genesis of our name, the Fleeing Artists, these are types of shows that don't typically get performed regularly in our community of Kenosha. And so we, as the Fleeing Artists, want to transform Kenosha into a place for art to come to. We want artists to flee from their various hangouts in Milwaukee, Chicago, and make Kenosha into the artistic capital of certainly Southeast Wisconsin, but maybe someday the world.
I remember asking you, Alex, when we first talked about this, what your relationship was, for instance, with the Lakeside Players, which of course is already ensconced here in Kenosha. And these performances, as I think we've already mentioned, are at the Rohde Center
right,
for the
where
Arts.
Lakeside Players is,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, which is essentially their home. And you were telling me that it's actually a very cordial and cooperative relationship that you are trying to forge. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, we love the Lakeside Players. I was on their board of directors for a number of years, and we love their works. And it goes back to that old saying, the rising tide raises all ships. I believe, and we believe, that all theater organizations, artistic organizations, even though, yes, we might be competing for audience numbers at the same time, as long as we are helping each other and supporting one another, there's nowhere to go but up for both parties.
This is your third production. You did some Shakespeare this summer to kind of kick things off. Were those performances also at the Rohde?
No, those were part of our Summer Shakespeare series. Mm-hmm. Over the past 5 years, our Summer Shakespeare series has performed at the Rohde. This year and previous years, we perform outdoors, free for the public, at various parks.
Very good. So as this company was sort of put together, what sorts of things were involved in creating it? I mean, what kind of nuts and bolts matters had to be addressed? And I partly ask that because sometimes when we think of fine arts organizations, we don't think much about the nuts and bolts. We tend to think about the artistic and creative expression,
sure,
that's you know, kind of at the heart of it and why we are even in such an endeavor. And yet, you can't have a viable and sustainable organization if you aren't thinking about matters mm-hmm. beyond the purely creative.
Sure. Well, when it comes to the logistical nuts and bolts, we started out by reaching out to the Kenosha Community Foundation, and they have been our largest benefactor thus far. They not only have contributed financially, but have supported us in terms of outreach, in terms of connecting with members of our community who are able to support us. They introduced us to the Kenosha Creative Space, where we're having rehearsals, and other individuals as well.
Very good. You mentioned that Ken Motley is your co-director and friend, so I just want to find out a little bit about how the two of you know each other.
Actually, I'm also one of the co-founders for the Fleeing Artists. Me and Alex have known each other since middle school. So it's been like 14 years or something like
wow.
that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's It's fun, you know. We're now roommates and stuff like that. We've been together for a very long time.
Sure. Well, we've been doing theater since high school. We're both from Appleton, Wisconsin, originally. Came down here to attend UW Parkside for college. And we've been doing theater for almost a decade now.
Yeah. Wow, very good. So, time for us to talk about this wonderful play, The Glass Menagerie, and we'll bring in our third guest in a moment, Denise Johnson, who plays the really critical role of Laura. So, Alex, say a word about how this particular play got selected for Fleeing Artists Theater to do.
Sure. Well, the genesis of that started 2 years ago when Kenny and I did our first co-direction, Death of a Salesman, at the Roadie at Lakeside Players. We worked so well together. It was such a positive experience. We began bouncing ideas back and forth of what we wanted to do next, and we realized, okay, Death of a Salesman, Arthur Miller, the next logical step, it felt like, would be Tennessee Williams. And we both had such an awe and respect for his work, particularly The Glass Menagerie, that we began talking about doing that independently. And then at the same time, that's how the Fleeing Artists idea came about as well.
Interesting. So yeah. This feels like the idea that's kind of carried the venture then.
It is, in some ways, yes, along with Summer Shakespeare.
Very good.
It was the spark that started the fire.
Yeah, nicely put. Nicely put. Before we delve into kind of the plot of this wonderful play, I'm curious to hear from each of you. And let's start with Denise, since we haven't heard from her yet. What previous engagement had you had with The Glass Menagerie before this production in which you are appearing in the role of Laura? Ahead of this, have you been in The Glass Menagerie before, or seen it, or studied it, or just like it? Or
I actually didn't really know anything about it before this. I read it right before kind of getting cast, and I mean, it was a great play. It's definitely tragic in the end, but it is a really amazing play, and I love being in it so far.
Great. But you've never seen it before, so.
No, I hadn't before, and then once I got in, then I started like watching videos of it and stuff, and one of my favorite actresses was actually in a rendition of it. Jessica Lange was in a rendition of it with Sarah Paulson. So they're two of one of my favorite actresses.
Right. Very powerful work. Ken Motley, how about you? What's been your past experience with The Glass Menagerie?
Well, I read it in high school. It was one of the books that we had to read in English class. Also, when I went to college, it was also a part of our theater history. So, and just reading the play and learning about Tennessee Williams and learning about, you know, the whole thing about symbols and themes and all that stuff and seeing how much he had that within the play. I just fell in love with all of that because, that's what theater is, you know. Mm. It's all about the themes and the symbols and stuff like that. So it was just really fell in love with the work after, you know, I read it, you know, both in high school and in college, and I've also seen it multiple times as well. So, you know, both on stage and on film. So,
very good. How about you, Alex?
Same as Kenny. I read it in high school, read it in college as part of text analysis. I saw a production of it at APT, American Players Theater in Spring Green. Saw the Rep's rendition of it a year or so ago, and I've been in love with the script since high school because of its unique poetic language, particularly. As an avid Shakespeare fan, I really hit it off with Tennessee Williams' work.
Very good. So I suspect that a lot of our listeners have seen Glass Menagerie one way or another, but for the sake of anybody who has not, it's probably important for us to describe the essential outlines of the plot, whoever wants to do
sure.
that.
Yeah, I can take care of that one. Let's see. So, trying to avoid spoilers, of course. Glass Menagerie is famous for being the quintessential memory play. It is told to us through the character of Tom, who functions as a narrator. He recalls the events leading up to things coming to a head within his family. I don't want to give away the ending, but the play is ultimately about family. His mother, Amanda, who is overbearing but means well, really means well, from the old South, the plantation South, mm-hmm. and his sister, Laura, who has crippling anxiety and shyness and prefers the company of her small glass animal figurines over the company of people. And things come to a head when Amanda decides, really pushes for her daughter to meet a man and try to find security for her through a husband, as was done back in the 30s when this play takes place.
Right. And so that gentleman caller whom you portray is that man. And I think he's secured through Laura's brother,
mm-hmm. Right?
They're colleagues at
at the warehouse. They work at a shoemaking warehouse,
right? And I'm trying to remember: is him coming over designed from the start to be a date for Laura, or does it sort of turn into that? Or
it is orchestrated by Amanda and Tom as a date, but he doesn't know it yet.
Right. So they orchestrate him to come over, and they just hope that. He will be enchanted with Laura and her gentleness and so on, and that will take it from there.
Right.
And, of course, as so often is the case, so well-orchestrated plans so often don't work out as we want. Denise, you play this crucial role of Laura. Tell our listeners more about her. What is important for us to know about her, and what has been intriguing for you to play?
Laura's a very shy character. You kind of see a little bit of her more open up with her family, at least in our rendition of it, compared to interacting with the gentleman caller. And you kind of see her retreating back a little bit, but then the more they get to know each other, the more she opens up. And she likes to play with her glass menagerie. And that is like a key thing, because that's kind of her safe zone. And I mean, just playing the character in general has been really fascinating. I actually went to school for psychology, so I kind of tend to analyze characters more. And she's definitely, you know, very shy, and, you know, to the point where it's like crippling shyness.
And she is also someone not only kind of mentally and emotionally fragile, but she also walks with a limp, right?
She does, yep.
Do we know from the script what that's about, or is that just kind of a mysterious point?
Well, the play is semi-autobiographical, based loosely on Tennessee Williams' life, and some of the characters are based on his family. His sister, his real-life sister, Rose, didn't have a physical ailment per se, but she, you probably would know better, but it's believed that she was diagnosed, would have been diagnosed today with bipolar disorder, right? So it is believed that the physical ailment as well as the shyness is sort of a symbol for that, or a metaphor for that.
Right.
Yeah, and also in the script, they also talk about how the character Laura, one of her legs was shorter than the other, so she had to wear a brace in order to extend it, and that's what the limp came from. You know, it's just she you know, one leg was shorter than the other, so she kind of developed a limp, and that's what happened there.
Alex, you're portraying the gentleman caller, and that's a character just about as intriguing as the character of Laura is. Tell us more about him and what we know from him simply from the page, what Tennessee Williams has put on the page.
Sure. Oh, he's an interesting character because he doesn't show up until near the very, very end. Tom introduces the characters as the narrator in the very beginning and talks about the gentleman caller as a symbol for almost the normalness that we yearn for. Jim is a regular guy. He has his whole life mapped out in front of him and the means to get there. He wants a family. He wants success. He's taking night school courses so that he can improve himself as a speaker, improve himself as a radio engineer, and get in on the ground floor of the television industry. Wonder how that'll go.
And of course, one thing is, if I remember correctly, that's so intriguing about him is that in high school, which is when Laura remembers him, I mean, they went to the same high school, and he was a very charismatic athlete, and I think involved in other things too.
Yep, champion of the debate team. He was he sang the lead in the operetta Pirates of Penzance.
And but by this point in his life, if I recall correctly, he sort of feels in some ways like his glory days are behind him.
Or yes,
it's like life has not played out exactly for him the way all of that early success might have suggested. So this is somebody who still has a lot of that charisma, but isn't the towering success that he maybe hoped he would be.
Right. For him, life has definitely slowed down a bit. He was going a mile a minute, always running and bounding, as Tom had said in high school. But he still believes he will achieve those glory days again.
Right. So, Ken Motley, you are co-directing this with Alex Metalski. I'm very curious to know how that is working, I mean, or how the two of you are working together as co-directors. First of all, we don't hear that very often. We sometimes hear about a director and an assistant director, but, you know, that's not the way you're describing this. Describe how the two of you are working together as co-directors, and how are you sharing directorial responsibilities here?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's... Well, the thing about it is we both work well together because we both are good at different things, and being able to come together and share our ideas and work off each other is just a big crucial thing for the both of us. I'm very good with my eyes. I like pictures. I like to look at colors. I like to, you know, I'm very, very good with my eyes. Alex is a very, you know, he's very good with his ears.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it's just like, hey, he's also very, he's very organized in a sense. I'm not. So it's very good when you have somebody there to just be able to work off of and to be able to lift up your weaknesses and compliment each other.
Right. And what I love about working with Kenny is, in a lot of ways, we're both, we're fairly experienced directors in our own right individually, but together, what I love about working with Kenny is we become better than the sum of our parts in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Ah, interesting. Yeah. Right. So what has this process been like of putting this play together? And I should think in particular when a play has as small a cast as this one does. I mean, is it four
actors?
Yeah.
Yep.
Chemistry between the performers is particularly important. Denise, how has that chemistry been working out?
I mean, I've known everybody that's in our cast for a while. I met Alex and Kenny and our Tom through Summer Shakespeare 2 years ago, which was when I actually started doing theater. And so, I mean, we all have kind of great chemistry because we're all really good friends, and it's kind of easy to, you know, give your opinions when everybody knows each other and kind of work together to make
a
great creation.
And that trust. Mm-hmm. Very good. So, did I hear that correctly? You're quite a newcomer to theater.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I did not do theater in college like they did. I started 2 years ago. I actually used to have really bad stage fright.
Ah.
So, yeah, 2 years ago. And then before that, I actually got my degree in psychology. So.
Interesting. Well, it sounds like you've conquered the stage fright. Wow, very good.
Yep.
So, Alex and Ken, describe what this production looks like. I mean, what kinds of things are you trying to do visually? And Ken, especially since you're the eye man here, visually, what does this production look like? And what is most important in terms of trying to create the setting in which this play lives?
Yeah, I think... we try to be authentic as possible. Also, lighting-wise, we try to be very intimate, I guess is the word I like to use. We like to use, like, some specials and stuff like that, isolating things that we feel are important. Like, you know, like the father picture and, like, other things. Don't, you know, want to spoil it. But, like, yeah, so, like, you know, just doing that, being authentic with, you know, with the style and being authentic with the time, also being authentic with, you know, with the whole Great Depression, you know, because, you know, that's a big thing. You know, this play takes place, you know, during that time. So having the sense of everything is being used, you know, it's very used. It's old. It's hand-me-down and stuff like that. So having that look of, you know, it's been worn, you know, it's been very worn and stuff like that. So just having that sense of it all, having a sense of everything in this house has been used, having a sense that everything is so small and claustrophobic because, you know, that plays into, you know, the character of Tom and him wanting to escape, you know, being so close and being, you know, in a small place all the time. You just want to escape. So, you know, just having that sense. And that's why, you know, we also chose to have it on the stage because we're on the smaller stage at the Roadie just so we can have that intimacy with the audience and the characters so that the audience can feel like they're inside their home with them and being, you know, as, you know, close to them as possible. Also being able to see everything, being able to see all the wornness and all that, you know, being able to see that, you know, they don't have that much money and stuff like that. We want the audience to be able to visually see that. Also, you know, like I said, lighting-wise, we wanted to be very intimate with that as well. So it's not like lights everywhere, you know, it's very simplified, you know. There are times where we add color, but, you know, most of the time it's just harsh light, you know.
And then an added layer to that is the fact that this is a memory play. And so with memory, in memory, some visual and auditory details are remembered crystal clear and others are very fuzzy for just about everybody. So certain aspects of this production are very highly detailed. You could walk up to it and inspect it with a magnifying glass and that it would be how it was back in the 30s. Other details deliberately fuzzy, deliberately obscure because certain things pop in memory. Certain things happen to music.
Right. Yeah. Denise mentioned that, particularly because she was not previously acquainted with this play, that she made a point of watching it as much as she could. In general, did you encourage your actors to do that, or did you leave that to each of them in terms of whether or not they wanted to watch other preserved productions of this?
We left it more to the actors to decide. Some actors love to see or hear as many renditions as possible to get a semblance of what how others interpret it and how they can add their own layer. Others feel like that would corrupt their own interpretation, and they don't want to steal from other actors, and so they keep away from it. Same with Kenny and I as directors. I saw the Katharine Hepburn television film from the 70s. As a rough jumping-off point, just because I grew up with that film.
I remember that fondly. She's marvelous.
Yes.
And I mentioned before we went on the air, I got to see on TCM sometime within the last couple of years a long-lost television production from 1966, I believe, with Shirley Booth.
Right.
And the audio had been preserved, which I had heard, but the video was thought to be lost, and then it was recently rediscovered
unearthed,
and so aired for the first time 50 years after the fact. So I guess it was 2 years ago, and that reminded me all over again of just how incredible this play is, how deeply, deeply moving. So what does it feel like for the actors when you are done with each performance? I mean, is this a play of this kind of wrenching drama? Are you exhausted and drained by the end of each and every rehearsal?
Well, for me, I personally, you know, having discovered that I do adore acting, for me, every rehearsal, while it's exhausting, it's also, like, it gives me adrenaline at the same time. So I am exhausted by the end, but it's, like, a good kind of exhaustion. And especially being such a sad play, and, well, particularly for me, then, you know, I have to really get into that mindset of having to be sad at that point. And, you know, it is a sad ending without spoiling anything. So, but afterwards I'm like, I need to hug everybody and get, you know, happy again. But it really does give me, like, a little adrenaline to be able to kind of use my emotions, because I'm Italian, so my emotions are out there.
Well, it's certainly a play with a very, very potent emotional heart to it. That is for sure. And each of these characters is so beautifully drawn by Mr. Williams, that's for sure. So, Alex, explain exactly where and when this production at Glass Menagerie is going to be presented.
Sure. So, Fleeing Artists, Glass Menagerie, it will be at the Rohde Center for the Arts. It's performing November 2nd through the 18th. Fridays are at 7:30, Sundays are at 2, and the first and third Saturday are at 7:30, and the second Saturday is at 3, because there is a casino night event going on at the Rohde Center on that second Saturday.
Ah, okay. Don't want to compete with that.
No.
So, and if people want more information, what should they do?
Sure. They can go to our website, www.fleeingartists.org, or they can check out our Facebook page that we are very prominently featured on social media.
Very good. Alex Metalski and Kenneth Motley are co-founders and co-directors, so co-founders of Fleeing Artist Theater and co-directors of this production of Tennessee Williams's The Glass Menagerie, in which Denise Johnson appears in the crucial role of Laura. So the production opening this coming weekend. We certainly wish you well with this run of performances, and certainly wish you well as you share with the public this really important theatrical masterpiece. And we're glad that you could join us today on The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I hope that you will take the time, as I did, to read a tremendously powerful and important book called A Thousand Sisters, My Journey into the Worst Place on Earth to Be a Woman. It is the absolutely true story of Lisa Shannon, a normal American woman who found herself caught up in a truly extraordinary mission when one day she learned of the plight of women in the Congo, and was inspired to undertake what at first was a solitary effort to raise money on behalf of women in the Congo, a solitary effort which quickly blossomed into something else. And she eventually made her way to the Congo itself to meet some of the women she had been trying to help. And that is the story of this incredible book called A Thousand Sisters. Lisa Shannon joins us to talk about her experience and about Run for Congo Women, which she founded. Lisa Shannon, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tell our listeners what inspired you to undertake this project, and a word about the timing of this project for you in the context of your personal life.
Well, I lived with my fiance, owned a stock photography business, and then one day I was home watching Oprah, and that is where I learned about the war in Congo. I think, for me, I was just shocked that here it was the deadliest war since World War II. Now it's like 5.4 million people who have died in the conflict, and I had never even heard of it. It's widely called the worst place on earth to be a woman. The sexual violence in Congo is off the charts. Hundreds of thousands of women have been gang raped, held as sexual slaves, tortured, and there at that time particularly was no discussion of it. So I felt like I wanted to do something. There was one woman's story in particular that really moved me. She was talking about being dragged away to the forest by a militia and begging for her life. And basically she was told by the militia, well, even if we killed you, what would it matter? You're not human. You're like an animal.
And no one would miss you.
No one would miss you. Hmm. That's exactly it. And for me, I just felt like, wow, it's not really surprising that a militia would say something like that to someone, but in a lot of ways, the international community has said the same thing.
Right.
That, when all these people die and we're not even talking about it, we're saying that we don't miss them and they're not important to us. So I felt like I needed to just find some simple way to send the opposite message, that they mattered to me.
I was struck by one of the things that Oprah, you say, told her audience towards the end of that remarkable program. Mm-hmm. Evidently, Oprah turned to the camera just before the program was done and said, you say, in unusually pointed tone, "Now that you know, you can't pretend you didn't hear it." And, of course, She was speaking to everybody in that viewing audience, presumably none of whom knew anything about the horrors of the Congo.
Well, yeah, in that show, she talked about what happened during World War II and the Holocaust and how at that time people pretended not to know. And I think her point was, you can walk away and choose to do something or choose to do nothing, but you can't act like you didn't hear it. Hmm. And that's what struck me, because I was always the sort of person, when I learned about the Holocaust, certainly when I learned about what happened in Rwanda, I thought, well, if I had known, I would have done something. So it was a critical juncture for me, and it wasn't just about helping Congolese women, but fundamentally who I believed myself to be as a person. And so it became a very personal effort for me. I just basically started with what I could think of, which was running.
Mm. So. You end up creating a 30.16-mile run, which was the length of a particular trail you love to run, and you wanted to raise 31 sponsorships for Congolese women through an organization called Women for Women International. One of your friends, in asking you about this, as you were kind of in the midst of organizing it and getting it off the ground, said that, "I bet the hardest part isn't the running." And your reply was that the hardest part was feeling alone. I wonder what your recollections are when you are presiding over something which has taken off in tremendous fashion. But It must be interesting for you to think about the earliest days of this effort when you probably did feel tremendously alone.
I was the only person I knew who was talking about Congo, and it was really hard, not only in the sense that I was working on it independently, but also there was almost a measure of suspicion on some people's part, like, there has to be a reason no one's talking about this, that there must be something about it I just wasn't getting, and that was tough, but because I felt really deeply that it was important and I wasn't going to be dissuaded, so I just kept going with it. But I will say, a lot of people hear situations like this and tend to feel overwhelmed. As long as I was focusing on something concrete that I could do, that sense of overwhelm disappeared. What's changed now is that there really is a movement for Congo in this country 5 years later. Mm. It just moves me to no end. There's a Raise Hope for Congo campaign. There are amazing groups all over the country, grassroots projects, people getting involved on their own terms. And, of course, Run for Congo Women has grown tremendously. So although the violence in Congo on the ground hasn't changed and women are still living through desperate circumstances, I do feel hopeful because more people are talking about it here. And in my experience, when people learn about what's happening, they want to get involved. They want to do something. Mm. They just have to have that opportunity. And then on the other side of that, Congolese women, when given the opportunity to rebuild their lives, have tremendous strength, tremendous resilience, and actually leadership, you know. So it's been amazing to watch that journey, not just for me or people here in the U.S., but also for Congolese women as they emerge as leaders for their own country.
We're speaking with Lisa Shannon about her book, A Thousand Sisters. Ahead of talking about a couple of specific matters from when you finally journey to Congo for the first time, which is really the story of this book, I was pleased that your book included other matters, other facets of your life, because
right.
it, in a sense, throws the story of the Congo women into even sort of sharper relief. One of the things, for instance, you mentioned is that your previous life before all of this overtook you was in the work of stock photography, which I gather from what you describe is those pictures we see of smiling people in picture frames in a department store or in certain ads and so on. I mean, they're people we don't know and we don't know where they are, but I mean, smiling pictures or whatever. And you and your fiance were producing that kind of stock photography. The fact that you take the time to kind of describe that work for us says something about sort of what you feel about that work now compared to the work you've undertaken on behalf of Congolese women.
Well, yeah. I mean, my job basically was to capture the image of happiness, what happiness is supposed to look like, what we're supposed to aspire to. And, of course, the great irony is that I travel to what's considered one of the worst places on the planet, but when I got there, I found out what real joy is, and that comes from being connected to other human beings. It comes from being open-hearted and doing what you can to help other people out. Nick Kristof, a journalist from the New York Times, talks about this all the time and talked about it in his book, Half the Sky, that consistently when people do something to help other people, what we get in return is enormous joy. And I think that absolutely has proven true for me. I mean, of course, I had to let go of a lot of that life. I mean, you know, my fiancé was very supportive the first year. And by the second year, he was done with that project and I was not willing to continue to focus strictly on financial goals. So we let go of the relationship and let go of the business. And I've been working full time on issues related to Congo for about 5 years.
When you finally do make your way to the Congo, you are, for all intents and purposes, traveling there on your own. And especially in those first couple of days, one of the thoughts which keeps crossing your mind is, should I be scared? When you would hear the sound of people shouting in the distance or see things or hear things. I that must have been one of the most bewildering experiences of all, to not know whether to be scared or what exactly to be scared of in a place so strange to you.
It was total disorientation. I mean, even at the hotel, which I had been told was secure, the first night I was there, a man wandered by with a 4-foot axe. And I didn't know, is he hotel security? Which it turned out he was. But I didn't know. All I knew was there was a man with an axe. I mean, it was so disorienting and disconcerting. I really felt, in those first few days, more paranoia than I've probably felt collectively in my entire previous life.
One of the most touching stories you tell is the very first time you visited a hospital in Congo where some of these women who had been brutalized and raped were receiving treatment. Tell our listeners about the first time you tried to speak to a ward of such women.
Well, you know, I had been working full-time for 2 years on this issue, and it was the first time that I met Congolese women survivors of war. And I just felt so overcome with emotion. I wanted to tell them how much I admired their strength and resilience, but I completely choked. I mean, I couldn't get a word out. And it was embarrassing because, you know, it was translated to them as pity. She feels very sorry for you, which is exactly the opposite of what I wanted to say. And at that moment, I told myself I wasn't going to cry again in Congo. So I think, you know, I had never been to Africa before. I made a lot of missteps on the journey. And I've made a conscious decision to include all of that imperfection and all of the wrong steps, because I think it's important for people to understand that we don't have to be perfect to show up. You know, we can just do what we can, not really knowing always the right thing to say, not always knowing exactly the perfect policy solutions to Congo, but just find some simple way to engage, and that has tremendous power and reverberations, and it's something that anyone can do.
I was struck by how you described your feelings as you stood before those actual Congolese women for the first time, and you said, "I felt impossibly insignificant." And of course, how striking for this American woman to feel herself so insignificant in this room full of women who themselves probably felt tremendously insignificant before you. And of course, your book is ultimately the story of the incredibly strong connections which you are able to build with these women in the Congo. You have just returned from your latest visit there. What is the situation?
Well, I mean, the situation for women has not changed. Women continue to be attacked by militias and by the Congolese army. Security ebbs and flows, but I visited villages where people had been massacred, 30 people killed in one day. So that kind of violence continues in eastern Congo. There are moments when it feels more hopeful and moments when it backslides into instability. But, you know, the remarkable thing about this visit was that we did our first Run for Congo Women in Congo. We had Congolese women who had been sponsored through the run turn out and do a Run for Congo Women to raise money for other Congolese women. And that, I have to say, was one of the most hopeful, powerful, joyful days of my life. It was amazing. I mean, we had one woman come who had a militia come to her home a few years ago. They killed her husband. They killed her child. They cut off her leg. She showed up that day in a red suit and pink pearls. And she did the run on one leg, barefoot. She managed to make it about, you know, a third of a mile. She took it as far as she could. And I asked her why she showed up, and she said, "Hey, look, you know, if I show up and I can run on one leg, then everyone will know that they can do something." I mean, she gave a speech in front of the mayor of Bukavu, this woman, you know, survivor. It was just so powerful to see women show up knowing they weren't going to get anything out of it other than helping other women. But that was really important to them and so healing. It was just an amazing day.
Right. You tell a story towards the very end of the book of coming back to the Congo and your bags having been lost. So you had all kinds of gifts and scarves and so on for them and nothing to give them in the sense of gifts. But one of them says, we don't need those things. What we need is you, as though they know that is even more important than gifts and scarves. And at the very end of the book, in something which is so moving, there is a list of names. Tell our listeners about that list of names.
Well, you know, one of the things I ran across in Congo, or rather didn't run across, is memorials. You know, in Rwanda, there are beautiful genocide memorials, but in Congo, even 16 years into the conflict, there's just nothing like that. So I put a memorial in the book, just a list of names or some personal detail about every person I encountered when I was there that I knew of who had died. So I looked through all of my transcripts, and any little detail, anything about someone who passed away, I included that person on the list. And I was very intentionally did not include anything about how they died, because I don't think that people should be defined by their violent deaths, but rather who they were and how they were connected to other human beings in their communities. So the book does end with that memorial. Yeah.
And it's striking how some of it is real names, I mean actual names, and sometimes it is the lady on the path, the man at the bus stop. I mean, in some cases, that is all we know about certain people who have been swallowed up in this terror. And at the very end of the book, we certainly want to say that there are you people are given a list of very specific things which they can do on behalf of this cause. And the book is called A Thousand Sisters, My Journey into the Worst Place on Earth to Be a Woman, the author Lisa Shannon. Lisa Shannon, my thanks to you for all that you've done on behalf of Congolese women and for writing this remarkable book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It is coming up on 9 o'clock. We'll have the news at 9:01. Then we'll join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming.